Had enough of the excuse-making, lack of accountability, and psychobabble? Then you're in the right place. You're listening to the Voice of Reason, and we're here to help you reconnect with your inner common sense. Now, here's the host of the Voice of Reason, Deneen Manette.
Hello, and welcome back to the Voice of Reason. Here we are again on a nice Tuesday, and I welcome you all back to the show. I am really excited to be with you today. I have some things I really wanted to get into, some things that I think are pretty important that I think we kind of need to talk about a little bit for the first two segments of the show. And then, of course, at the end, we're going to do our infidelity segment. Once again, my name is Deneen Manette. I am an infidelity expert. I am a criminal investigator who graduated from UC Berkeley with my bachelor's and my law degree from UC Hastings College of Law. And I've been working in the field of criminal investigations for 24 years. The mother of three kids. I don't think I've ever told you all about my backstory, but I have two grown sons and a 9-year-old daughter. And I have done a lot of work dealing with kids over the years. I've done a lot of work in juvenile probation. I was a juvenile probation officer for many years. I've worked in the 300 system, which here in California is where the abused and neglected children go and who have mental health issues and social issues. And so I've had quite a bit of experience dealing with not only children, but also dealing with parents. And one thing that I really kind of have come to the realization of is that when kids are really, really screwed up and they're really off track, you kind of can figure out what went wrong once you meet the parents, like 95% of the time. And I catch a lot of flack. I'm on Dr. Drew's show on HLN, and I catch a lot of flack from people who write in to me or catch up with me on Twitter or whatever, saying that I just really put too much pressure on parents and that I hold them way too accountable. But I am sorry. I just really have seen that parents are typically, now, you know, of course, we have mental health issues and other things that go on, but typically the parents are 95% at fault for what these kids turn out to be. I remember working at Juvenile Hall, and we would have some of the most screwed up kids that were smearing feces on the wall and that were fighting all the time and that were completely and totally disrespectful and were just off the hook. And then we would have visiting day, and I would go out and I would meet some of those parents on visiting day, and I would say, ah, it's all making sense to me now. It became so clear to me why these kids were so screwed up. These parents would come in drunk, if at all, like they would show up the last 5 minutes of visiting. You would see them sitting in the rec room where the visiting would take place, playing dominoes and cards with the kids. And I'm thinking to myself, this is just a normal outing for them. I mean, this is not anything very critical. Your kid is here for homicide or robbing an old lady and grabbing her purse or all kinds of stupid, ridiculous, outrageous things. And you're just sitting up here just shooting the breeze with them like this is okay. And you're half drunk or just half clothed. And it's just, it used to just really unnerve me because I would see how many of these kids completely and simply just never had a chance. They just didn't have a chance. Once you would see what they came from, you would recognize that there was no structure, that there was nobody in charge, that there was nobody who was interested enough to really give them the direction and supervision. And I used to say to myself, they come in here and they spend an hour sitting here talking and playing cards with these kids. Imagine if they had taken that hour to sit and talk and play cards with their kids every Saturday up until the kid went to jail. Imagine how much of a difference that could have made in that kid's life if instead of waiting until they get in trouble and waiting until, you know, they're locked up and you've got to put on this hat and go show that you're the good mom or the good dad, if you had taken the opportunity to sit down with your kid for all of this time and give them this interaction, not necessarily lecture or teaching, but just time. If you had just sat there and just spent this time with them over the years, imagine what the outcome would have been. Can you, I mean, my opinion was that the kid probably wouldn't have been in juvenile hall. So I just think that, parenting style, parenting actions, the way we interact with our children is critical to how they become the adults that they end up being and the decisions and choices that they make for the rest of their life, quite frankly. So I just, you know, I really need to address that. I think that that's something that is very, very important. And I just think that with Father's Day coming up and the fact that fathers are a segment of the population that honestly and frankly don't get as much recognition as the mothers do. Mother's Day is one of the biggest selling holidays. It's one of the biggest things that is, you know, that Hallmark and all of the holidays, everybody is kind of focused on moms and making sure Mom's Day is celebrated really specially. And I just don't think that dads get the recognition a lot of times for the effort that they put in and the real good, honest to goodness down, you know, in the trenches, fathers. Not the ones that come and visit occasionally when it's convenient for them, but the real and true fathers. I remember after the Sandy Hook situation, I was reading something. I follow the mom of one of those little girls on Facebook. She has a group for her daughter, and I follow some of her postings, and they just break my heart. And one thing that she posted was that after the Sandy Hook tragedy, she received hundreds and thousands of cards and letters to her, addressed to her, offering her comfort, offering her support from other mothers in the community and other people that sympathize with her. But that, comparatively speaking, the child's father had only gotten about 11 or 12 letters specifically to him. And it's as though he had to suffer differently in his grief, having been a father. He had to suffer in silence, per se, because people reach out to the mother and they look at what she provides and the fact that she does carry the child in her womb and they connect with her. But the father oftentimes gets forgotten. And we don't really pay attention to how important dads are. And, you know, to me, this is a really, really very, very important thing. And another reason, not only is Father's Day coming up, and that's a very important holiday that I think it's glossed over and not given the significance of Mother's Day, but 365 days and 2 hours ago, my father died. He died on June the 9th of 2014. And it's been a very, very difficult year for me. I lost him to lung cancer. I knew he was dying. I watched the process through hospice. It was the most devastating event that I can remember. And I just, you know, I really, really think that people need to recognize the significance of the father in the lives, especially in the lives of his daughter. It's the type of a relationship that sets the tone for how that girl goes on and faces life. And I'm going to share with you something that I wrote for my father, that I wrote for him for Father's Day about 6 years ago. But to me, it was just so important. And I just really, really want to share it because I think that it speaks to so many different aspects of fatherhood. And I shared this with him and I shared it with several other men that I know who are fabulous, outstanding, excellent, caring fathers. And it just to me speaks to exactly what it is that I'm trying to say. The role of fathers in our society. People talk about, you know, dads are, you know, they really need to be there for their boys. Well, they really need to be there for their girls too. It's not just an either or thing. It's not more important that they're there for the boys. I think it's just as important, if not maybe even more, because he sets the standard of what a girl will tolerate and expect in her life. So this is a piece that I wrote for my father, and I'm just going to share it with everyone because I really believe that this speaks, like I said, to the true essence of fatherhood and to what is important and what should be important in fathers, in acknowledging and recognizing and appreciating our dads. This is for fathers. True, loving, caring, responsible fathers. Not sperm donors, not yearly visitors, but actual, real, in the trenches, hands-on fathers. This is for fathers who see their children every day, and also for those who don't, but whose presence in their children's lives is always felt and always appreciated. Fathers who realize that money is important, and material things are nice, but a hug is priceless, and a compliment is invaluable. Fathers who understand that they are their son's best example for how to treat a woman and have set the standard for their daughters for how they should expect to be treated by a man. This is for living fathers who take the time to provide encouragement and guidance often, and for dead fathers who left an indelible imprint on the souls of their children. Fathers who are not afraid to hug, ashamed to cry, reluctant to ask, or unwilling to try. Fathers who play with their children, pray with their children, and stay with their children, and are as comfortable at a football game as they are at a dance recital. Fathers who, regardless of how challenging, try their very best to brush, part, and gather delicate hair into tiny pink elastic hairbands. This is for fathers who strive to provide for their children and make them feel safe in this often frightening world, and who understand that one of the best things they can do for their child is to respect and not speak ill of its mother. Fathers who are not afraid to take charge of their own household and understand that the ultimate responsibility for the fitness and direction of their family lies with them. Fathers who kiss their sons and tell their daughters to quit whining and are neither reluctant to discipline nor to pick out dresses and Sunday morning tights. For fathers who gave it their all, yet their children still went astray. And for fathers of angels in heaven, you too have been a blessing to your child, and this is also for you. Although I may not have recognized it earlier, but as an adult, I now see that the words and the action of my father are the roadmap to where I am today and where I'm going. He was the first man that ever loved me completely, purely, and unconditionally. So to my father, Donald Bailey, as well as all of the other hardworking, committed, loving, consistent, strong, caring, dedicated men we call Daddy, happy Father's Day, and thank you. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Voice of Reason. Here's Deneen Manette.
Hello, I'm back, and we have been talking about fathers and the importance of fathers in their lives, in the lives of their children. And I'm glad that I was able to share with you all the piece that I wrote for my dad. And I'm glad that I was able to take a break after I finished reading it, because quite honestly, it's a very emotional thing. And like I said, it's a very emotional day. This is the day that I lost my father last year. And I think that, you know, people just really need to recognize if your father is still here and if he is still in your life, reach out to him. Reach out to your father. If he was a good and decent and kind and loving and supportive person, reach out to him. Even if he had struggles, reach out to your father. Fathers are such a blessing. And I knew my father was dying last year. And so what me and my sister did is a week before Father's Day, I didn't know if he was going to be here for Father's Day. And I decided that I was going to celebrate Father's Day on the Sunday before Father's Day, because I was not going to let a calendar dictate me celebrating and appreciating my father. So we got presents and cards and everything, and we convinced him that it was Father's Day, because it was, quite frankly. And we celebrated Father's Day. And I told him the same things that I have told so many other men in my life, and that I actually said at his funeral. The things that are so critical that he did for me, and that I think are so important for fathers to recognize and do for their children, especially their daughters, especially their daughters. And I'm speaking from a daughter's perspective. So I don't want to cancel out relationships with sons, but I'm focusing on daughters because I was a daughter and I have a daughter with a father. And I just think that people don't recognize a lot of times the importance of the things that fathers do and can do and the impact that they have on their daughters' lives. They need to empower their children. Fathers need to empower their daughters, not tear them down. You need to compliment them. If I am hearing from my father, wow, what a beautiful dress. Oh, you're so smart. Oh, you're so lovely. Oh, you're so kind. You have such a great heart. You're such a hard worker. If I'm hearing these things from the man in my life that is the first person who loves me unconditionally, it's going to carry with me. And I'm not going to go out and feel the need to hear these things from so many other little boys and young men that have a different agenda. I'm hearing it from my father. I'm getting built up and appreciated and loved and supported and complimented by my father at home. I'm not going to now feel the need to go out and search for that validation from other men and other young boys who have a different agenda most of the time, especially at a young age. I'm getting it at home, so I'm confident, and I go out into the world a much stronger, a much more confident person. And that is why it is critical that fathers pay attention to the things that they do and the words that they speak to their children. It is very, very crucial, because your words can make or break the self-esteem of especially your daughter. Your actions and the things that you do, humiliating your daughter, can have long-lasting effects. And that brings up a particular story that my producer sent to me today. And I was able to look it up and research it, about a girl in Tacoma, Washington, a 13-year-old girl who committed suicide after her father's public shaming video was posted online. This story is absolutely heartbreaking, and it speaks directly to what it is that I'm talking about. In this story, a 13-year-old Washington girl took her own life after her father recorded a video of him punishing her. And it sparked a debate over public shaming, the same debate that I brought up a few weeks ago about parents publicly shaming their children. And what is the purpose? Who benefits from that? Is it about the child, or is it about the parent wanting everybody to say, oh, you're such a great parent, for them to get these kudos? When actually, quite frankly, it's bullying. It's parental bullying. But in this situation, the little girl, her name was Isabel Loxamana. She gets out of her car and she jumps from a highway overpass. Landing on the interstate below, was rushed to the hospital, and she died. How dramatic. How tragic. How final. This little girl did not slice her wrists. This little girl did not overdose on pills. This little girl did not do something as a cry for help. This little girl did something final and traumatic. She jumped out of a car and leapt over an overpass. My God, are you serious? The amount of pain that an individual is in to jump from an overpass, a 13-year-old, how desperate she must have felt. Of course, there was other things going on in her life that led up to this, but obviously the tipping point was something that was done by her father, the person that is supposed to love and support her. This suicide came after a 15-second video which showed her father questioning her about something that she'd done. It doesn't really go on to say exactly what it is that she'd done that caused him to make this video of her. It's an unspecified behavior. But in any event, he's telling her, saying her to her off camera, the consequences of getting messed up, huh? The father says. And the little girl, you know, she's standing there, and the camera is panning back and forth from the little girl to a pile of her hair. He has chopped off this girl's hair. Looks like he's chopped off about a foot of it. And she's got this nice little Dorothy Amel little cut now. But he's panning back and forth from the pile of hair to the little girl and asking her questions. And he says, man, you lost all of that beautiful hair. Was it worth it? Whatever it was. Was it worth it? The little girl says, no. He says, how many times did I warn you? The little girl says very quietly, twice. Really? Now, many people have criticized the father online, and the police are saying that the father didn't upload the video and that the video was not meant to be published, but somehow or another, somebody got a hold to the video. Seriously? Why are we even doing this? Why are we videotaping our children's punishments? Why is this okay? I mean, the fact that it got into the wrong hands, or so the story has been told, this sounds like it could be the spin doctor to me, because my BS detector is going off on this one. I just don't think that a father could have videotaped something and it was just left on his phone, and then his daughter got a hold of it and shared it with her friends, and one of them posted it online. I mean, I don't know. Maybe that happened, but to me, like I said, my BS detector is going off crazily right now, because I just can't see that happening. I can more likely see the father sharing it with somebody who thought that it was horrible or thought that it was funny, and they uploaded it. So, you know, he says it wasn't meant to be shared. I don't even know why it was taped. I don't even understand, you know, why people make permanent records of things that have the potential of getting out. And this was something that obviously had detrimental consequences. So in any event, it gets out, and, you know, the police department, strangely enough, Tacoma public information officers are coming to the defense of this father, saying, you know, she was a 13-year-old that made some poor choices, but she didn't have to kill herself. Oh, shut up. Shut up. What do you mean she was a 13-year-old that made? We all 13-year-olds make poor choices. Good Lord, have the internet been around when I was 13? Jesus Christ, I don't even want to think about it. So, yeah, all 13-year-olds make poor choices, and no, she didn't have to kill herself, but obviously she did kill herself. So for whatever reason and for whatever was going on in that house or in that family or in her life, she felt that that was the only option for her. And guess what? She did not have a soft place to fall at home. The mother is never mentioned in this article at all. Only thing that is mentioned is the father. And, you know, he apparently, according to them, he intended the video to be a personal reminder for his daughter's eyes only. But sadly, it prompted her suicide, apparently. And even if, like I said, it wasn't the sole reason behind her suicide, this girl was obviously hurting. Apparently, she went back to school after this video was posted and was brutally bullied by her peers and by her classmates. She was relentlessly and brutally bullied. So basically, he did something as a supposed loving, kind, caring father. I guess that's what he's supposed to be, trying to discipline his child. But he publicly shamed her to the point where she felt that she had no other option. I don't know if she had mental health issues, but he should have known if she had mental health issues. I don't know if she had drug abuse issues, but he should have known if she had drug abuse issues. And if you see someone or you know someone, or even worse, if you love and care about someone that you know is teetering on the edge of a cliff, do you push them? Do you blow on them with a strong gust of wind so they'll fall over and hit the ground? Or do you support them and love them and show them that you care and that you're merciful and that you are someone who actually gives them some consideration? Do you provide a warm place to fall, a soft pillow, a place of comfort and of acceptance? Or do you give them just enough to send them over the edge? And that's apparently what has happened in this situation. And that's what I find to be so incredibly painful about this whole ordeal. I find it so horrible that regardless of what his intention was, that he felt that it was an okay thing to do to bully his child. Because that's exactly what this is. We worry about our kids going off and becoming, being bullied at school or being bullied by their peers or whatever. But then what happens when they come home, and when they come home, they're bullied there as well? I mean, what is that all about? What does that teach our children when they are getting the same or worse treatment out in the streets or in the community or at school or whatever that they're getting when they come home? They can't even come home for refuge. If this daughter was off track, certainly he could have come up with another way to get her back on track. Certainly he could have come up with another plan or another method to pull her coattail or to reform her behavior to be acceptable for him. So that's what I mean when I say, fathers, don't tear down your daughters. Don't bully your children. Don't publicly shame your children. It happens way too much. You know, first of all, you set the standards. You set the standards for how your daughter is going to be treated by other men that come behind you. You teach her about whether or not she should stand up for herself and feel confident, or whether or not she should cower because a man is bullying her. You set those standards. That so often, women find people that are exactly like their fathers, and they wonder why, when their father was abusive, physically abusive, a raging alcoholic, emotionally abusive, they wonder why their daughters find themselves in this same pattern of abusive relationships, because they set the standard right out of the gate. That was something that was very important and that needs to be impressed upon dads. Another thing that I was taught and that I think is very important is to teach your daughters independence, not coddling. You don't help them by crippling them and making them an emotional wreck and unable to fend for themselves and to do things for themselves. You've got to teach them to be independent and to stand up in this world, to be able to go out and grab the world by the horns, quite frankly. My father gave me, for my 20th birthday, my Christmas present from my father, get this, was a power drill. I got it in the mail. It was wrapped up. It was beautifully, it was, you know, all in tissue paper. It was beautifully wrapped. I was really excited. This present was so heavy. So, of course, I assumed that it was some type of electronic equipment, a new Walkman, something that was, you know, that was something that I really, really wanted. And I opened up the box and I saw that it was a picture of a power drill. So, of course, this must just be the box that my great stereo is wrapped in because, you know, he must have put it in the power drill box. I opened it up and it was a power drill and I sat there and I scratched my head and I'm like, what is this? What am I supposed to do with this? A power drill? It was orange and black and it said Roble on it. And I said, what? R-O-Y-L-B or something. I didn't know what it was. I said, what am I supposed to do with this? So I called my dad and I said, thank you. He said, you like it? You like it? Okay, now get out there and get to work. I said, okay. So I sat down with the power drill and I read the instructions and I plugged it up and charged the battery and oh my gosh, that thing changed my life. I started tightening screws. I started putting stuff together that was in boxes. I was fixing chairs. I was outlet covers that had gotten loose and had twisted around. Oh my goodness. I was tightening and repairing everything in my apartment. The little drawer handles, the things that get really loose when you open and close the drawers too much. I was grabbing my power drill and putting it on the inside of those things and screwing them close. Oh, I could not be stopped. I felt so empowered. Who would have thought that a power drill would have been so empowering? But I did not have to wait for anybody to help me do anything. I didn't have to wait for anybody to help me put shelving units together. I didn't have to call and ask a couple of guys I knew or get a boyfriend to help me do things. I was able to do them myself. I felt so independent. So guess what? I'm getting my daughter, when she goes off to college, I'm getting her a power drill. And I'm going to keep the power drill thing going. It's going to become a tradition. I'm going to buy power drills for young girls that I know who are going off into the world. It is such an empowering thing. I really, really encourage people, get your daughter a power drill. I know it sounds silly, but the independence that a power drill gives a girl, you can't match it. So that's something that's just, that was very, very, very important. And I just, I praised him for that. On his deathbed, I told him, Dad, that was one of the absolute best gifts you could have ever given me. And I was so glad that he had given that the forethought and taken the time to give that to me. Another thing that was very important that I'd really like to impress upon dads is the language and the way that you respect your daughter. I was never cursed at by my father. I was never called out of my name. I was never called stupid. I was told you did something stupid, but I was never told you're stupid. The language that you use, and even though it doesn't seem that it's that big of a deal, oh, it's a big deal. It's a big deal. The words that are used in speaking with your child, with your daughter, the words that you use, the vocabulary that you pick, the phrases that you use to the terminology, it's really, really critical. And it's very, very, very important. So that's another thing. The names and the things that you call your daughter, don't be surprised when her boyfriend or the guy she's dating calls her those same things. And what's worse, when she answers to them. What people call you is one thing. What you answer to is something completely else. So don't be surprised when that happens if you decide to use a few bad terminology, call your daughter a bitch or whatever. Don't be surprised when that terminology is used by others because she's learned to accept that. And that's the standard that you've set. Make time for your daughter. Make time. I told my daddy every single time I called him, he answered the phone, whether he was at work, no matter what he was doing. Even if he answered the phone to say, baby, let me call you right back. I'm in the middle of a meeting. Or honey, let me call you back in 10 minutes. I'm heading to something. Or I got somebody else. I'm in a meeting. Something. No matter what it was, he took the time to take my call. Time is so, so important. They say that you should make 7 bridges. You should have 7 bridges of connection to your child. 7. So that if one of them falls down, you have 6 more. Going to church together, playing a game together, doing a sport, jogging together, or something like that. Being in a club together. Whatever it is, you need to have 7 bridges of communication. Because something is going to ultimately break down. But if you have those other things that are in place, then you can still pick up where you left off. A show that you may watch together every night, you know, it could be some type of drama show or some reality show, whatever it is, just something that you do, some connection that you have with your kid, and you should try to strive to have 7 of those things. Outings, dates, taking your daughter out on a date, opening the door for her, showing her how you expect a man to treat her or give her that example of how she should expect to be treated, is absolutely critical. Spending time. I remember fishing with my dad. That was one of the most wonderful experiences, trying to get the worm on the hook and fishing with him. And the time I caught a fish and he didn't. And then I got to eat my own fish. While everyone else, while we were camping, had to eat hamburgers, my daddy let me eat my own fish. That was so important to me. I caught my own fish. I caught my own fish. That was really, really, really critical. So just spending that time, raising those standards, making sure that they have that independence, holding your daughters accountable. Don't let them off the hook. I don't know, Daddy. All that crying and carrying on. Okay, here's the tissue. Wipe your tears and tell me why you thought that was a good decision to make. You know, that's how you deal with your girls. You don't let them collapse and whine and cry and make them feel as though that's their way out. That's their ticket to get mercy. You make them stand up and explain themselves. Explain their actions, explain their behaviors and their words and their decisions so that they can articulate their thought process. Make your girls accountable. Don't just take care of everything for them. Step up and make them take care of things on their own. Make them go up to the guy at Home Depot and ask him the question. Don't just wait around for somebody to come and ask you if you need help. Teach them to take charge, take control, be independent, get out there, and be self-sustenance. Make them just get on their own, stand up, put on their big girl pants, and get out in the world and handle things. That's what these wonderful fathers are doing, need to be doing. I praise and support and applaud those that have it together. I'd like to encourage those that are still working on it, but I'd like to appreciate fathers. I really think that fathers don't get enough appreciation, and I'd like to just take this moment to give you my cyber handshake, pat on the back, hug, high five, fist bump, whatever, for those that are out there doing the job, getting it done, making it work, making it happen. And happy Father's Day in advance for all those fathers out there, including my own father in heaven, who did so much and worked so hard to make me the person that I am today. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Voice of Reason on TalkZone.com. Here's your host, Deneen Manette.
Hello, it's Deneen Manette, and I'm back again, and we're going to switch gears now. I was getting to a point in the last segment where I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to get through it. So I'm thinking we need to switch gears away from the entire father thing. That's a very emotional topic for me, especially, like I said, with my father having passed last year. And so I got a several questions this week, and some of them I think are very, very important and are need to be dealt with. Every week we spend the last, 15 minutes or so talking about an infidelity issue, an infidelity question. And I always have more than one, but I only get to one. And people have been emailing me and telling me, they really, really like the infidelity segment of the show, and they wish that, we could talk about it a little bit more. So since this is a good day that I need to get off the emotional stuff and talk a little bit more about infidelity, I have some really good questions today, and I think we could really delve into the meat of them. And so I'm going to give about 5 extra minutes today to actually maybe get through a couple of these questions, maybe 3, but at least 2. Once again, I am an infidelity survivor, an infidelity expert. I wrote a book called Ultimate Betrayal, Recognizing, Uncovering, and Dealing with Infidelity, which is basically a layman's guide to uncovering infidelity in your relationship. Instead of having to hire a private investigator and having to go through all type of expensive cell equipment and all types of stuff, you can come up with this stuff on your own. You can figure it out a lot on your own. And what I have helped people do is recognize when their relationship is in trouble and recognize when there could be something going on in their marriage or in their relationship, and they are suspicious that it could be infidelity, but they're not quite sure. And it's a really, really traumatic experience. It's something that I think so many people have gone through or are perhaps going through right now, whether you're at the phase of uncovering something in your relationship, feeling as though maybe your partner is being suspiciously behaving, or whether there's something going on, whether you have some red flags or some telltale signs or whatever, or whether it's something far more serious that you've actually caught your partner, caught your mate or spouse, in the throes of a relationship, whether it's tearing up your marriage now or whether it's something that you're in the process of trying to work through. But either way, there are tons of different levels of the infidelity thing, whether it was 10 or 15 years ago and you still haven't quite recovered from it and you're just still trying to get over it, or whether it's something that, you know, you've moved past and that maybe you can share your experience with others and maybe help them work through what happened with you. But in either event, I've done a support group for years. I've helped people who are dealing with infidelity. I've helped them work through this in their marriage. And, you know, funny thing is that most people believe that it's all the men that are cheating and that the men are involved in cheating and that women are usually the victims. But I found that it's actually 50-50. I mean, the men are cheating with somebody, right? And the fact that the internet is here and available and we've got all this social media and all of this stuff going on, it makes it an awful lot easier. It makes it easier to cheat, but it also makes it easier to uncover infidelity. And the fact that nobody leaves your life anymore, the fact that you can, you know, back when I was young and you went off to college and you didn't, you know, have any more interaction with this person. You knew where their parents live, but you could go on the rest of your life and not really see this person anymore. Well, now we have Facebook, and now we have social media, and now we have pictures that you post, and it's just as easy as Googling somebody and finding out where they work and getting in touch with them and reconnecting. So nobody is really out of your life anymore. And because of that, there's a lot more infidelity going on. You see the pictures of how they look and people, you know, who looked really crazy and skinny and bucktooth as teenagers are now grown-ups that are filled out and handsome and that are looking great. And it sparks curiosity and interest in others. So, yeah, you know, you may have a relationship that ended, but now you want to go and peruse through somebody's Facebook albums and see their pictures or follow them on Snapchat or whatever. And you become intrigued with the person that this person has become, or maybe you have, you know, you've never quite ended the relationship emotionally. So that's why infidelity is becoming such a more pronounced thing than it ever was before, because it's easier and because people know about things a lot more because of social media. So anyway, let me jump into the first question that I think is pretty meaty. And I received it from a woman named Brenda. And Brenda says, I've been married for 14 years. My husband had a very long-term affair with a coworker, and even though he no longer works with her, they no longer work together, I'm still having trouble dealing with this. I cannot seem to get the images out of my mind of them together. Every time we pass a hotel where I know they used to meet and have dinner and drinks, or every time I see a car that resembles hers or hear someone who has a similar name to hers, I just go crazy. It makes me sick. I cannot seem to shake this. He's very remorseful, and he's trying really hard to fix this, but I just don't know if I can continue to deal with this. The problem is that I know that if I leave now, I'll look like the bad guy, and I don't want that to happen. What do you suggest? Well, Brenda, I am really sorry that you're dealing with this, because this is a living hell. And I don't know how long ago the affair was, because you didn't specify how long ago it ended. I know that you said that it was long term, but you didn't specify how long in the past, you know, logo in the past was it? Was it like a couple of weeks ago or a few years or whatever? But anyway, the images of an affair and the aftermath of the sickness that continues to be a part of who you are and your interaction with your spouse goes on for a very, very, very long time. And we call this triggers. These are called triggers. And triggers are triggering events, triggering things. It could be a song on the radio. It could be a photograph that you look at and you see a picture of you and your husband on a vacation, and your timeline tells you that that was the time that he was having an affair with this other woman, and that will trigger you. You can eat a food, go past a restaurant, as you said, pass a hotel or a motel where they used to do the do or whatever, and all of a sudden you break out in a cold sweat. You get angry. You start crying. You start shaking. You start feeling sick to your stomach and you want to go throw up, you know, preferably on him. But whatever it is, these are triggers and they are real, and they can come on at any time. They can come on at a meeting at work. They can come on when you're dealing with your kids, when you're alone, preferably when you're alone. But unfortunately, it's not that simple. They can come on driving down the freeway. So these are real, real events that take place, and they're very, very painful. And the way that you deal with triggers oftentimes has to be abrupt and out loud. There are something called thought, where you can stop your thoughts altogether, where you can just interrupt, thought interruption process, things that you can just come up with to make these feelings and these thoughts come out of your head. And some people do things that are a little bit, you know, less intrusive, like putting a rubber band around their wrist. And when they start having these obsessive thoughts, they start snapping the rubber band to make it stop. Sometimes you have to yell as loud as you can and slap your hands no matter where you are and start saying, stop, 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 stop. That's what I used to do. Stop, stop, stop. And what that does is it interrupts the psychosis pretty much and the obsessive thoughts. It makes you start concentrating on something else. And luckily, hopefully, if you happen to be in the presence of your spouse, when these thoughts come up and you start doing this thought diversion technique, stop, 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 they'll know exactly why you're doing it. And sometimes they look over and they'll know that, okay, this is a good time for me to eat crow, sit here with my tail between my legs, and recognize that she's going through something over there, and I think I'm just going to leave her alone. So that is a really, really good way to do a stop, to stop the obsessive thoughts, to stop the, you know, feelings of nausea, or to at least break the cycle of your current thought process. Those are two tactics. There are plenty more. Just Google thought diversion tactics. Come up with things or ways that just make your mind go to something else, because these things are going to keep coming up. They're going to keep being a part of your reality. They're going to keep being a part of your relationship, and they're going to keep coming into your presence. They're going to continue to be a problem for you until you get to a good distance past this affair. Sometimes they'll continue intermittently forever, but they become a part of who you are every day, at least for the first few years that you're dealing with the aftermath of this affair. Now, I need to take a break, but I'd like to come back to this because there's a lot more in this question that needs to be addressed. So we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to get back to Brenda's question. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to the Voice of Reason. Here's Deneen Manette.
Okay, so we are talking infidelity, and I am discussing Brenda's question. Brenda wrote in about her husband having had a long-term 14-year marriage. Well, they had a 14-year marriage, and he had a long-term affair with a former coworker, and she's having trouble getting over the obsessive images, the imagery of things that she's seeing that brings back the affair, songs, whatever is she's going through. And I'm explaining that this is something that is completely normal, happens all the time. And it's not just with affairs. It happens with any traumatic situation. You continue to have the imagery and you continue to relive it. Sometimes you can smell something, eat a food, go to a restaurant, whatever it is. It's something that takes you back to the place where you were. And what is it, like PTSD? It's kind of similar to that on a much lower scale. But it's similar to that. It's something that just brings you back to that emotion of a time that you were deeply, deeply hurt. And it's a deal. You know, it's a really big deal. It's something that hinders you from moving forward and to recovering from your relationship. And Brenda states that her husband is very remorseful, and he's trying really hard to fix the situation. I'm glad that he doesn't work with this woman anymore. And I'm wondering what he's doing to be helpful. But the fact of the matter is that after an affair, the relationship is just not the same. Now, sometimes the relationship can be better, and sometimes it can be better because it opens up lines of communication that had previously been closed, or that the couple was unaware were closed, and it allows them to reconnect and dig into their marriage and find out what went wrong and what led to this incident happening, because an affair, like I've said many times, is not typically the problem, but is a symptom of a larger problem in the relationship. So sometimes when this cry for help causes the couple to reevaluate their relationship, then they can fix what's broken and can go on to have a better relationship. But more often than not, it leaves something there. It takes away from the sanctity of the relationship, the purity of the relationship, because you now know that this person is capable of hurting you beyond belief. This person that has professed love for you is now capable of hurting you beyond belief. And it's not the same. The intimacy, sadly, is often not the same. You have an inhibition. You're wondering whether or not you're being compared to this other person. You're wondering if you're as good as them. You're wondering if your spouse is thinking about this other person when they're being intimate with you. And you don't often have the desire to reach out and be emotionally connected to this person the way you were before this happened, because the love was so pure and it was so innocent and wholesome. And now it's tarnished. And sometimes doesn't recover from that. You have a wall built up around yourself to keep you from being hurt, and rightfully so, because this person came in and permeated the trust and the wall of your relationship, and now you've got a barrier built up, and that barrier does not go away anytime soon. Sometimes never. Often never. And so when someone has an affair, they need to recognize that you are doing irreparable harm to the relationship. And though, like I said, it can be repaired when that is symptomatic of a greater issue, there is still a level of distrust that may stay dormant, but you now know this person's capabilities and what they're capable of doing. And you keep your cards closer to your chest. You aren't as giving and as freely emotional and loving a lot of times. So even though he's doing everything that he can be doing, this is really difficult to fix, and it's not a short fix. It's definitely not. It's definitely something that is long term. And, you know, I really find interesting Brenda's statement that says, if you leave now, you'll look like the bad guy. She says, if I leave now, I'll look like the bad guy, because her husband is doing everything to repair the relationship. Let me make something clear, Brenda, and anybody else out there who's in this situation. Just because you did not leave the marriage when you found out about the affair, that does not mean that you've given up your right to ever leave, okay? Just because you didn't pack your bags and go then, that doesn't mean that you now have lost all of your rights to walk away. What this person did changed the relationship. It's not the same relationship anymore. You made a commitment to stay in the relationship that you two stood up in front of, that rabbi, that priest, that pastor, that minister, that judge. You made that commitment and made that bond to be in that relationship. This is not that relationship. This is a different thing. This has a whole different parameter. So just because you decided to stay initially, you've not given up your right to leave. And if you're going to stay with that person just to continue to give them 50% of yourself, or to constantly berate them or antagonize them, or every time they say, honey, I love you, oh, did you love me as much as you loved that bitch? I mean, do you know what I'm saying? If your purpose is to continue to just pile on and be just a horrific partner, then, you know, it's probably better for you to leave. It's better for you to leave somebody than to stay in a relationship where you now become abusive. So if your inability to recover and to get back on track is going to cause you to now become the abuser in the relationship, then it's better for you to cash in your chips and leave the table. Now, on the other hand, if you staying in that relationship and you cannot, you're not the abuser, you're not continuing to berate or harass, but you just can't love this person like you want to be loving them. You don't feel as though this relationship is something that is strong and is solid and is that you're committed to, then you don't have to stay. If you feel as though you've done the work, you all have been to the therapy, you tried to work it out, and you just don't love this person the way that you did before they ruined the relationship, The 14th Amendment came along. Nobody owns anybody. We can leave. There's nothing holding you there. There's nothing saying that you have to stay with that person just because they're acting right now. They've ruined the relationship. So sometimes you just don't get a second chance. You may have tried to give them a second chance, but you are not committed to staying in that relationship forever. So Brenda, if you've done the work and it's just not working out, you need to reevaluate whether or not it's even healthy for you to continue to be here. But that's something that needs to take time. And like I said, I don't know how much time you've put into this already. So don't take that off the table. Don't say that you don't have permission to leave because you chose to stay. That's my suggestion to you. Now, I'm going to try and get into this other question really quick because it's really short and I only have about 2 or 3 minutes left. But this question is from Kelly. And Kelly says, I told my best friend that her husband was cheating on her and now she won't talk to me. What's up with that? Kelly, I'm sorry. This happens all the time. What's probably happening is one of two things. Number one, she is embarrassed and humiliated and doesn't want to face anybody and has drawn back away from you because of the fact that she just feels like crap and she's in a shell. And if that's the case, you need to kind of go out and reach out to her. The other thing that could be going on, which I think is probably more likely, is that she's going to stay with him. And they're going to work it out. And she's embarrassed about that. She's embarrassed because you know that her man's cheating and she's decided to stay with him. She's embarrassed. And she can't face you. She feels humiliated. She thinks that you're going to judge her. I don't know if you're going to judge her. I hope that you're not going to judge her. But she may feel that you're judging her. She may feel that you're in judgment of her. And she doesn't want to deal with you because of that. So she's going to cut her relationship with you, which is sad because you're best friends. She'd rather cut your relationship with you if it's going to inhibit her from being able to repair her marriage. If you are not going to judge her, and if you are okay with her choice and whatever decision she makes, which unless this guy is beating the crap out of her every day, should be something that you're more inclined to do because it's really honestly not your business, then you need to let her know, look, honey, you do what's best for you and your relationship and your kids and whatever, and I'm supporting you, my friend. I don't support what he did, but I support your relationship and you being happy and in a healthy home. And if being with him and working it out will get you to that point, I support that. You need to articulate that to her, number one, okay? Number two, I can't have you beating up on him. I can't have you, like, refusing to talk to him when he comes in the room. If she has made this decision, like I said, if he's not beating the crap out of her, if she's made this decision and it's in your mind seems like, you know, it's going to be what she decides to do, I can't have you like berating him. If you're going to do that, then just don't come around them because it's something she's trying to work on. And if she feels like her marriage is fixable, I need her to try and fix it. And I don't need her to feel as though you're coming down on her, criticizing her, berating her, attacking her, doing anything. What I need you to do, if you can't stand his ass and if you just want to be away from him and you just don't want to look at him because he makes you vomit, then you just be available to her by text or by phone for when this comes crashing down, if this comes crashing down. You just make sure she knows that you're still her best friend and you're going to be there for her. And if she needs you to go out and you know, get over him at the bar, you be available to get your purse and keys and meet her at the bar, whatever it takes. But I just need her to understand that you support her as a person, whether you support her decision or not. You support her as a person, that you are not judging her at all, and that you will be there for her because you said that she's your best friend, not your coworker, not your neighbor, not somebody you give a damn about. She's your best friend. I'm assuming that because she's your best friend, she knows where the bodies are buried because that's what best friends are. The other friends, you know, but your best friend, they know where the bodies are buried. So I'm assuming that you guys are tight like that and she needs to understand that, hey, you guys are going to go the distance. She's your pal. She's your buddy. You're going to support her and that you're going to be there for her. That's important. So once she recognizes that, if she decides to not talk to you anymore, there's really nothing you can do about it. But I just need you to reach out to her and let her know that, hey, you know, this is your thing, girl. Do you? So that's it. I was really hoping to get to another question. Didn't work out this week. Maybe next week. I hope you all have a fabulous rest of the week. And I will see you right here, same time, same place next Tuesday. Take care.
Thank you.